Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, in a conversation that's being recorded on the 31st of August, 2017. I always get the question in from the listeners, what book should I be reading? Well, here's a book for you. It's called Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. It is by Mr. Scott Horden, who I am sure is familiar to a large section of my audience, but if not, you should check out The Scott Horden Show. You can find him directly at scotthorden.org. He's also managing editor of the Libertarian Institute, which published this book at libertarianinstitute.org. Scott, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right. Well, you know, with most books, it's a good idea to start at the beginning. But actually, with this book, I think it's maybe appropriate to start at the end because of recent events. And you end with some pretty stirring words here. If the Trump administration could be certain that the people were overwhelmingly opposed to the war in Afghanistan and that we should stand by his decision if and when he ordered the generals to pack it up and come home, it would at least theoretically give him a context in which it would make political sense to do so. And then you end with Americans must prioritize opposition to the destructive of war in Afghanistan and work together to end it now. Amen to that. But of course, what was it, 1 week after you published this that Trump came out with his grand reveal of the new Afghan strategy, which is Obama Surge 2.0, more of the same. Let's send more troops into the grinder. Yay.
I knew I should have waited.
Yeah. Well, that's,
you know,
that's
they kept
really
kicking the can down the road on the decision for like 2 weeks at a time. So I kept delaying publishing the book for like 2 weeks at a time because I knew it wasn't early enough to have an effect on the decision at all or be part of that debate. So I thought, well, I got to wait. Yeah. But then they kept delaying it and delaying it. And all of my friends were telling me, Grant Smith and Gareth Porter, everybody, just publish the damn thing. Just publish the damn thing. And of course, 5 days later, he makes his big announcement. So I've actually updated it. It's got an updated version. And it's not very updated. It's not much different than what you're looking at there. But it is updated to reflect the fact that he went ahead and ordered the.
All right. So there's already a second edition.
Is still there.
All right.
The part that you just read is still in there because I do still believe that if the American people who don't support the war, if they decide they were actually against the thing, then I think that we could get him to flip-flop right back again and actually end the thing, because I think it's the one war out of all of them that he doesn't really believe in.
Well, certainly not from any of the rhetoric pre-election, anyway. Obviously, that changed when he got into office, as it always seems to do somehow or other. So let's start after the end. Let's start about this, because it's still in the news. For people who don't know, what exactly is being ordered here?
Well, I mean, just keep fighting. I mean, that's their strategy. Their strategy is that, well, go back to 2009. David Petraeus promised Obama if he did his big surge, then in a year and a half, that is by July of 2011, he would have the Taliban at the negotiating table at his bayonet point, simpering and signing whatever we told him. And that was the deal. Well, that never happened. Well, so the supposed lesson from that is that, see, Obama should have never given any kind of timeline. Petraeus, they'll never blame Petraeus, but he should have never given any kind of timeline. What you want to do is never promise any specific results. That way you never fall short. So this time they actually have as their first premise that there is no deadline. It is not time-based. It's conditions-based, which we can get back to that. But that basically means whether the local army is doing good or bad, we got to stay is what conditions-based means. And then their premise, their big fake premise that they've all agreed on up there apparently is that once the Taliban know that now after 16 years, we promise we're never leaving, then they'll go ahead and negotiate. The only reason they wouldn't negotiate before is because Obama had announced the timeline. So if we just keep fighting and if we have unlimited patience, then someday. And according to McMaster's plan, this isn't supposed to happen for another 4 years or so, at least till the end stages of his recent strategy, which is a 4-year plan. Then maybe we'll negotiate. And that's what Trump said in his speech, too. That, well, you know, I don't know. We don't know what might happen. And then the other part of the other half of the strategy basically is we're going to tell the Pakistanis, no more Mr. Nice Guy, no more carrots. Now it's all sticks. You better stop backing the Afghan Taliban. When, of course, that's not going to happen because it's a primary national interest of the Pakistanis that they have, you know, friendly players in action in Afghanistan, that the Indians' allies are not ever able to create a full monopoly on power in that country. And so they're just not going to do that. I mean, the Trump administration, their strategy actually includes, well, you know, if the Pakistanis won't stop backing the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network, Maybe we'll ask China to ask them to stop for us. When, of course, that's the whole reason we're backing India in the first place, is as a check against China and their alliance with Pakistan. So this whole thing is completely ridiculous. I mean, I guess you read the book, so you see in there, there's this think tank lady's former CIA analyst, Lisa Curtis, and she wrote a thing for the Heritage Foundation or one of these foundations, this big study back in February, and McMaster hired her and put her on the National Security Council and put her in charge of this strategy. And if you read the thing, the big report that she wrote back in February, you'll see where she barely pays any mind to the Pakistanis' interests here at all. She actually dismissively just says, well, you know, America's interest in backing India and Afghanistan may not be completely compatible with what the Pakistanis want. But then that's it. May not be completely compatible. When, in fact, that is the single first motivation. That is the motivation for Pakistani interference on the side of the Taliban in the first place. She refuses to acknowledge that and then recommends a policy that is absolutely certain to fail.
Yes, it's overwhelming. But I, you know, here's a testament to the ridiculous nature of this war is that Americans and ISAF country forces generally have been involved, embroiled there for 16 years. And I guarantee you, you just lost most of the audience going into even that level of detail about who is fighting and what's going on. We need the overview here just to tell us, where is Afghanistan? Who are the constituent tribal groups and ethnic groups here? What are the divisions? Who are the Taliban and who are they fighting against? And what side is the U.S. on in all of this? Just break it down to brass tacks for us.
Okay, sure. And I'll take brass tacks also as a disclaimer, too, that this is obviously overly simple because I have no choice and I'm from Texas. Never been there, but okay. So we're talking about South Central Asia, basically. Central Asia is usually the area north of there, Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and all that. Afghanistan's south of there. It's to the east of Iran and to the north and west of Pakistan, because Pakistan is sort of shaped like a upside down seven or something like that, a backwards capital L, I should say, in a way. So Afghanistan is, you know, above that to the north and to the west of there. And it's a landlocked country. It's about the size of Texas. It has mountains like Colorado, deserts like California. It's absolutely inhospitable terrain. It has an ancient ancient civilizations there that have grown up in these valleys in between these mountain passes over the thousands of years. In the north of the country, you have Hazaras, who are Shiites, Uzbeks and Tajiks primarily. There are also Sikhs and other Turkmen and other minority groups. And they are basically make up the minority coalition of the Northern Alliance. They're leaders. I don't mean the populations. Those who have seized political power over those populations, they are the Northern Alliance. They are really the government that America has backed in Kabul there in the capital city since 2001. And on the outs are the Pashtuns. Now, they're not the majority, but they are the plurality. They're 40% of the population, and no other ethnic minority group comes anywhere close to that. So they are predominant in the east and in the south. And of course, they also cross the line. Their population crosses the line into Pakistan. The British drew what's called the Durand Line, that western border of Pakistan, in order to divide the Pashtun tribes from themselves in the first place. So there's plenty of overlap, and they don't even necessarily recognize that border, depending on which tribe you ask at what time. And so I don't want to be way overly too simple and say that the Pashtuns haven't been included in the government, because that's not really true. They have. In fact, Hamid Karzai was a Pashtun from Kandahar City and the son of a very powerful former warlord who was already dead by the time Karzai came to power. But still, but the point being that overall, the government and especially the army represent the interests of the Tajiks and the Uzbeks, and I guess less so the Hazaras, but especially the army is, and the officer corps and even the rank and file are mostly made up of Tajiks from the north. And so George W. Bush and Barack Obama's entire policy for 16 years has been to attempt to foist this coalition minority government on the plurality of the country. And who are also very, I mean, certainly not completely, but are very geographically separate. So it's not like everybody's just all intermixed together in all these ways. I mean, they really are separate geographically speaking. And so it would make sense, not that the Americans should come in here and do this instead, but I'm just saying, all things being equal, you could see Pashtunistan maybe splitting off or having a situation, if there ever was a negotiated settlement here, where they have, you know, supreme autonomy and remain inside the state of Afghanistan, basically in name only. You could create some kind of very strong federal system. I mean, in the real use of that term, where the different provinces would really have much more of the power. And then maybe it wouldn't matter as much who ruled Kabul. But the Americans, of course, believe in a strong central government. That's who they are. And so they just refuse to basically accept the fact that these people, you know, are determined to remain independent. So this is not a perfect analogy, because whites in America are still 60-something percent of the population. But, you know, more or less, this would be akin to if, say, I don't know, the Chinese or some foreign power came to the United States and said, well, we're going to create a coalition government of the Chinese, the Japanese, blacks, and Mexicans, and they're going to rule all over Whitestan or whatever. I mean, pretending that whites were really geographically kind of separate from the rest of the country in some way. It's just not going to happen. There's just too many people to conquer, and they're all armed, and it's just, it's a fool's errand. It's stupid on the face of it. You can tell just on the face of it, this can never work. So, and the Pashtun people, it's a warrior culture. Long before Islam ever came to Afghanistan, they love to fight. They always have, and they always will. You know, Eric Margolis told the story back in the 1980s of following a Pashtun tribesman with one artillery shell in a backpack. For 2 weeks, this guy climbed mountain over mountain over mountain. Margolis following him. He gets to a cliff with an artillery tube sitting there waiting. There's a Soviet base down below. He drops one artillery shell in, fires it at the Soviets, turns around, and goes back again. And these people are not ever going to give up. And that's it. It's an equation for failure. There's just nothing else to say about it. Can't work.
The other question, I guess, then being, was it ever designed to work? And it, there was a lot of, I mean, there's obviously so many details in here, so many footnotes to so many different sources, but one that really stuck out for me here in Chapter 3, you're quoting from a SIGAR, S-I-G-A-R report, I don't even remember what that stands for, early 2017, where they say, adjusted for inflation, the $115 billion in U.S. appropriations provided to reconstruct Afghanistan exceeds the funds committed to the Marshall Plan, the U.S. aid program that between 48 and 52 helped 16 West European countries recover in the aftermath of World War II. That blows my mind. Adjusted for inflation, this is greater than the Marshall Plan. And I don't know where Afghanistan ranks on the list of world countries by GDP, but it is not up there very high. It is just insane, the amount of money that's been pumped into this, let alone, of course, all the human life and suffering. It really does beg the question, was it ever meant to be won in the first place? And perhaps that's answered by the title of your Chapter 3, The Long War. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that war is a racket. And there are a lot of interests. It's just like when we talk about Iraq. Why'd they invade Iraq? Well, how long you got? Because there's a lot of different answers to that. None of them are good enough. But combined, they amounted to a casus belli somehow. And that's sort of the same thing here. Why are we even there? I don't know. I mean, it could be that there's some assistant deputy secretary of state who's pulling some levers to make sure some peace talks never happen because of his relationship with a warlord we've never heard of. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up. But I'm just saying, there's the point is that all these government employees are all individuals. They all have their own interests. Some of them want to get more ribbons on their shirt. Some of them maybe want to sell more drugs and cash in that way. Some of them want to, you know, just check their box and get home and try to get that promotion. I think that's what drives most of them. None of them want to admit that they were wrong. None of them want to admit that they were, you know, off on a mission that could not possibly be accomplished. Just kick the can down the road, make it somebody else's problem later. Makes more sense. And so, you know, you combine any and all of these reasons, and none of them are good enough. Even if you throw in the fake safe haven myth, that, you know, terrorists will always use Afghanistan as some convenient base to attack North America or something like this. You know, none of it's good enough. But yeah, there's a hell of a lot of money involved in there. And so then, and also look where all this money's going, right? The money is going to create a state that that could never sustain itself, as you said there. Afghanistan is one of the poorest countries in the world. It's a desperately poor country. And their entire economy's been completely destroyed, reduced to almost nothing but poppies. They used to have, you know, very diverse agriculture there. But ever since the 1980s, really in CIA support for Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, way back under Ronald Reagan, this is what really got the ball rolling on beginning the heroin economy of Afghanistan. And there's basically nothing else. And people talk about all these minerals, but you have to have long-term safety and security in order to develop those mineral resources. For those kind of investments, you need highways, you need, you know, railroads and the trains to drive on them and everything else. None of this is happening in Afghanistan or is going to for a long time. So not only we spent more than the Marshall Plan, but it's to build a government that will absolutely mathematically disintegrate. There's no argument. It would disintegrate without American continual support virtually forever. We pay their, you know, billions of their budget, their entire gross national product, including all the heroin, is like $4 billion a year. And that's with some small percentage of the cost of the government itself. And the government, just the government's expenses are more than the gross national product of the country. And that goes throw in the army and the police forces and everything. The entire project can never be sustained other than taking the money out of the paychecks of the American people.
Ridiculous on so many levels. And you say, let's throw out the safe haven myth. And even then it doesn't add up. And I think you're right about that. But let's throw out the safe haven myth once and for all, because if you ask 100 Americans on the street, what on earth is Afghanistan, the Afghan war even about? I'm sure 90 plus of them will probably say something about, well, wasn't it Al-Qaeda and, I don't know, 9/11 or something? And how does that relate to 2017? Well, that would be an interesting follow-up question. But obviously you and I disagree absolutely vehemently on the official government 9/11 conspiracy theory about the man on dialysis in his cave fortress in Afghanistan directing the 19 men with box cutters to get NATO to stand down for the morning so that they could deliver PNAC their new Pearl Harbor that they were lusting after at least since September 2000 with their Rebuilding America Defenses document. But one thing we absolutely do agree on is that it was never about getting Osama bin Laden. That was, in fact, something that was specifically forbidden by the military higher-up brass. Do not go in there with your Marines. We've got them cornered in Tora Bora, but do not go in there and get those last 100 remaining fighters. You got to let them get away. Absolute ridiculous nonsense. Tell us about the Osama bin Laden safe haven Al-Qaeda's going to get us if we leave myth.
Okay, first, I don't want to get too far into the debate, but I would say that, you know, the official story in the sense of like what George Bush said or whatever is, to me, a straw man. That's not the real argument. The real argument is the one made by James Bamford and by Peter Lance and Terry McDermott and all the great journalists that showed that Al-Qaeda did that attack. And no, they didn't attack us for their, you know, because we're free and innocent and leave them alone all the time. Like in the official story, as I explain in the book, they explain why they did it very well. So I agree with you that, you know, the very dumbest version of the official story is very dumb, but I don't think that that necessarily means that it wasn't Al-Qaeda that did it. But anyways, I mean, I certainly agree with you that they let him go. Well, I have one caveat on that. You know, they did drop a daisy cutter bomb, a 15,000-pound bomb on Al-Qaeda there at Tora Bora. And they were calling in F-15 strikes and all that. And, you know, there's a former CIA officer named Robert Grenier who wrote a book where he says, yeah, you know, all this stuff about Tora Bora. And yeah, they should have sent the Rangers and the Marines. I agree. They should have. But what happened really was the decision was already made that they were going to let the tribal fighters kind of take the forefront. And the CIA was going to run it in this and that. And it was more like bureaucratic politics in D.C., you know, kept the and maybe even Rumsfeld's, you know, personal upset at being preempted by the CIA in the initial stages of the war that kind of got in the way rather than a deliberate plan to let them go. But what is absolute, and look, it's a matter of interpretation. You're not going to ever find anyone on the inside who said, yeah, George Bush snickered at me and said, yeah, we're going to let him go like that. Right.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of interpretation. But, you know, arguing against my own point. They did drop some serious bombs on those guys. It just they got about half of them, but the other half escaped. But it absolutely is the fact that they had Rangers available right there at Bagram Air Base on the Shamali Plain, which is like 50 miles away or 100 miles away from Nangar Province. They could have marched the soldiers there. And then the same for Mattis's Marines. And I forget exactly where the Marines were stationed at this point. I'd have to go back. But it was our current Secretary of Defense, Mattis, and he wanted to go, and he was denied permission to go.
Right. And throw in Seymour Hersh's Airlift of Evil, because I think you only mentioned that briefly in the book.
Yeah, and in fact, I didn't even go back and reread that piece, which I should have before I cited it. But I'm trying to remember The Great Escape, or do you remember the name of the article?
I thought it was Airlift of Evil. Maybe that was just some title that it was given, you know, in...
Yeah, I mean, that might have been in there somewhere, but yeah. Anyway, you may be right. But anyway, yeah, it was... they actually created an air corridor and allowed the Pakistani Air Force to airlift, although I don't think that this was bin Laden and Al-Qaeda's guys, and Al-Qaeda guys there from Tor Bor. I think this was the Taliban.
I think the implication was they were mixed in, but I got to reread the story.
It could be, yeah. I'd really have to go back, and very well could be that there was some mixed in there. But I don't think that. I mean, the worst interpretation is that they went to go get bin Laden and Zawahiri and fly them out, and Bush let them do it. But I don't think that that's exactly what Hersh was reporting there. I don't think he believed that.
Right. Well, let's get to the safe haven.
They certainly were embedded with the Taliban, and a lot of the Taliban leadership were flown out.
Let's get to the safe haven part of this myth, because even if we do take all the Al-Qaeda story and everything at face value, the idea that if you leave, suddenly, you know, terrorists will flock to Afghanistan because it's a prime location to launch international terror attacks,
right,
is, I mean, ridiculous, but let's deconstruct that.
Sure. I mean, it's amazing. And again, okay, for sake of argument, we have a disagreement here, but for sake of argument, the Bamford version that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and friends organized this thing with the blessing of bin Laden, that Mohammed Atta and his buddy, I forgot which one, Ramzi bin al-Shib and maybe a couple others had been to Afghanistan and met bin Laden, and that this was the plot. Well, look, the Hamburg cell of hijackers, they were the Hamburg cell. That's not a city in Afghanistan, right? They were Egyptian engineering students studying in Germany. And then once they had access to Germany, to Western Europe, for whatever reason, and the rules that meant that they had greater access to the United States. And I believe all of the 9/11 hijackers were in the U.S. on either student or tourist visas. Maybe one of them had a work visa or something like that. But they had to hijack our planes to have anything to crash into anything, right? There's no Afghan Air Force. You look at a map, look at a globe, Afghanistan is the far side of the world from everywhere. Afghanistan itself is exile. And there's certainly nothing magic about Afghanistan as a safe haven in terms of terrorists being able to step into some porthole and all of a sudden be at Boston Logan Airport or something like that. I mean, they talked on the telephone is what they did. You know, the switchboard house in Yemen. This is the Bamford story in the Shadow Factory.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talks about how, you know, the Yemen switchboard house. And anyway, so in the first place, there was nothing about Afghanistan that made it, you know, good for attacking Americans, other than it was difficult to hit back at bin Laden and his friends there in Afghanistan. But not that difficult. I mean, clearly, as Michael Scheuer has shown, he had 10 different chances. Bill Clinton did. And the Senate actually at one point claimed he had 13 different chances to kill bin Laden in Afghanistan. It's not hard to fly some Navy planes over Pakistan and over to the Tarnak farm and drop a couple of 500-pound bombs on it. They just didn't do it. That's, I guess, a whole different rabbit hole to go down. But, so then now look at what's going on. We've had, and I count them up in the book, there's more than half a dozen terrorist attacks in the United States by domestic so-called lone wolf terrorist attacks here, including Omar Mateen at the horrific Orlando nightclub massacre, including the Boston bomber, who cite the war in Afghanistan as their motivation to do this. In fact, there's a former Marine sergeant who now writes for The Washington Post named Thomas Gibbons Neff. And after Boston and the cops reporting that this is what he'd written on the inside of the boat, that this was about Afghanistan, he said, well, I used to tell myself that it was okay that I was fighting the Afghan war because it was a closer trip to come and fight me than to go to America to fight Americans. So I was, you know, in a sense, as their shield, protecting them. But that doesn't make sense if the wars themselves are motivating attacks against us, to which I would say, ding, 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 it was George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton killing people that started this in the first place, not 9/11. It was the Americans who started it. It was always Americans over there killing people. That was the motivation for the attack. And this guy, Neff, finally figured it out. But we now see that the longer we stay over there, the more and more attackers come. In fact, the train attack in Germany, the kid was a refugee. He'd been assimilating quite well, according to everyone. He'd been doing really well. He lived in Germany for a year, and he was getting along fine until he got word that the U.S. had killed his friend back in Afghanistan in an airstrike. And then he went on the internet and, you know, virtually signed up with ISIS, recorded a little video, got on a train with a hatchet and started attacking innocent people. And people want to say Islam, Islam, Islam. Well, geez, the German police said he was mad because the Americans killed his friend. Is that so hard to understand, really? It's easier to blame religious motivation or to blame PNAC than to say, like, yeah, people get pissed off when you murder their family members, murder the people they care about most.
Well, you make the point in the book that it's as if for all commentators on this war and any of the war on terror wars that history started on September 11th. But hello, what was happening in Afghanistan in the 1980s? Who was involved there? What money was being put in into what groups? And where do people like Gulbuddin and Hekmatyar and others get their foothold and their strongholds and become warlords and become masters of the opium trade and all this? Where does this come from? And how was this fostered in the first place? It's not that Afghanistan is some vacuum that just suddenly was filled after 9/11.
Right. Well, and this is the theme of the book, that it's the Vietnam trap is what this is all about. As in fact, Iraq has replaced Vietnam now in the lexicon, which is pretty revealing, but you know, when we were growing up, the word Vietnam didn't even mean a place over there or even, you know, a war. Vietnam meant a stupid mistake, a horrible self-inflicted wound where you, you know, basically screw your own country up, break the bank, cause all, you know, cultural and economic and political disruptions of all kinds and lose anyway. And wish you'd never done that. That was all wrapped up in just the word Vietnam. That's what it meant. And so what happened was, and John Mueller shows this in his book Overblown, that after Vietnam, the American people had what our government calls the Vietnam syndrome. They didn't want anything more to do with that. And Zbigniew Brzezinski and a couple other bright thinkers inside the empire decided, you know what? Instead of containing communism, then let's go ahead and trick them into overexpansion. We see what harm the Vietnam War just did to us. Let's see if we can give them their own Vietnam. And so on July 3rd, 1979, Jimmy Carter signed a finding, an order to the CIA to begin covert support for the Mujahideen so that they would attack the communist Russian Soviet-backed forces in Kabul in order to provoke an overreaction, in order to provoke the Soviets to invade. And when they finally did invade, Christmas of 89, Zbigniew Brzezinski at least claims that he sent a memo to Jimmy Carter saying now is our chance to give them their own Vietnam. And then this was such a actually, you know, got out into the popular culture, as I'm sure you know. There's a scene in Rambo 3, which is all about supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, where Rambo's, and I quote this in the book, his mentor, Trotman, explains to the Soviet Union KGB officer who's captured him that these people can never be defeated. They rather die than be slaves to an invading army. And you can't defeat a people like that. We already learned our lesson. We already had our Vietnam. Now you're going to have yours. Ha, ha, ha. So, and you find this in the writings about the 80s intervention over and over and over again, that the people of Afghanistan are to be sacrificed in order to hurt the Soviet Union. Well, and if you ask a Reaganite, they will tell you, that's right, Ronald Reagan destroyed the Soviet Union, and he did it through building up nuclear missiles and forcing them to get back into the arms race, canceling detente and bringing back up brinksmanship, and by back in the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which forced the Soviets to win this horrible no-win war. And, of course, they had also expanded their responsibilities and obligations in Latin America at the same time, too. And that this is what brought them down. And, well, bin Laden learned that lesson, too. And they said all through the 1990s that this is what they were trying to do. They were very open about it, that what they wanted to do was give the Americans their own Afghanistan. And in as Afghanistan. They had done, as the Americans had helped them give to the Soviet Union before. And so here we are accomplishing that mission for them. You're a truther. I'm a reverse truther. I think that George Bush and Barack Obama have been working for bin Laden and Zawahiri all along because it's their ultimate goals that are being accomplished here at the expense of the people of Afghanistan, the entire Middle East, and the United States of America, for that matter.
Well, Scott, I kind of halfway glance at some of the headlines in the MSM that are never wrong once in a while, and I saw something about ISIS in Afghanistan now since, what, 2014? So I guess a bunch of Iraqi Arabs crossed over Iran somehow or other and ended up in Afghanistan. I don't know. But so clearly...
Aha! Iran! No, I'm just kidding.
What's going on? ISIS? Really?
Yeah, so thanks for asking me that, because this is such an important point, and it really makes me mad, and full credit to Moon of Alabama for noticing this. I saw Moon of Alabama get in a fight with somebody on Twitter and linked to this, and I went and found this great article, Afghan Analysts, about how ISIS in Afghanistan are just the Pakistani Taliban. That's who they are. And when Obama expanded, you know, did the surge and did the so-called AFPAC war, which meant the CIA drone war in Pakistan at the same time in 2010, they also fought against the Pakistani Taliban, because that was who Al-Qaeda was hiding out with there. And they hired the Pakistani government, the army, to do these multiple invasions of the Swat Valley to attack the Pakistani Taliban. Well, some of them fled to Afghanistan, and they fled to Nangarhar province in the far east there, which is right around Tora Bora, where bin Laden had escaped back in 01. And they came in. It's a really interesting story. They came in, they laid real low, they just brought their families, they started hanging out like everything was cool. And then after about a year, they put up their flag, pulled out their guns, and said, "We're the government around here now," and took over the place. But they're still just local Pashtun tribal fighters. They have, you know, they claim ISIS, you know, just the same as you could open up a Dairy Queen franchise or whatever, but doesn't make you corporate headquarters. In this case, just as before, they're fighting our guys because they're on their front lawn. And the Afghans in the past have shown, you know, no, well, they just haven't. I don't know. Maybe they would someday or whatever. But they have not come here to attack us. You know, the Pakistani Taliban did send Faisal Shahzad the attempted Times Square bomber. But other than that, The Afghan and Pakistani Taliban, they have done nothing to us other than fight our guys on their own front lawn. And if we withdrew, I don't see for one second why we should believe that they would follow us home, come after us. They never had an interest in doing that. I mean, it's a specific strategy of Al-Qaeda to attack the far enemy, the U.S. first. One, because that was sort of how to unify the different parts of the Al-Qaeda group in the first place, but also because their idea was that as long as America backed all their local dictatorships, they could never overthrow them. In fact, look at what happened. Baghdadi tried to create a caliphate with, you know, I don't want to truncate the antecedents here. Obama supported the Mujahideen in Syria until it blew up in his face so bad it ended up creating an actual Islamic State there, which is not what they wanted, I don't believe. And so then they went and they did exactly what Zawahiri would have predicted if Baghdadi would have obeyed him. He wouldn't have done it in the first place, because the Americans came, bombed it right off the face of the earth. We see it right now. 40,000 something dead in Mosul, and nobody knows how many in Raqqa. It's an absolute catastrophe. And which really goes to show that now America is proving Al-Qaeda's theory right, that you have to completely get the Americans out of the region first. Only then can you try your local revolution. So where al-Nusra and ISIS have been fighting a sort of parochial jihad lately, we're actually, the U.S. policy is actually proving Zawahiri right, that they should be attacking us instead, you know, according to their own doctrines. I hope people don't misunderstand what I'm trying to say here. Yeah. According to their goals, it proves him right, that it's too early to try to do a local revolution. You got to get rid of the Americans first. And how to get rid of the Americans? You can't scare them away. They're the superpower. They're the world empire. You have to break, their bank, and just like the Soviets, and that's the game. And it's a long game. I don't think Bin Laden ever thought he was going to be the king of Arabia. He didn't care about that. He was in it to win it if it took 100 years.
Well, I think, sorry to keep you too long here, but I think we have to go back to the why then, because, I mean, the first several years of this, the reason you heard thrown around in the anti-war movement all the time was the pipeline. It was the pipeline. It was all about the pipeline. Obviously, that never eventuated. Now, in recent years, we've seen the USGS survey and others claiming, you know, this is the Saudi Arabia of lithium. This is what it's all about. But none of those explanations seem to add up. Is there a deeper why?
Well, I agree with you about both of those, first of all. But second of all, honestly, I mean, I'm going to invoke Gareth Porter here. It's the interests of the bureaucracies themselves, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the CIA, and the rest of the intelligence agencies. For those bureaucracies, their interests are in keeping working. And that comes down to it. In fact, I got a couple of great quotes. It was sort of the out of the mouths of babes kind of thing. One from the New York Times, one from Defense News, where they basically say, geez, now that Obama's pulled us out of Iraq, it's the U.S. Army, the Dagger Brigade. Now that Obama's pulled us out of Iraq and is beginning to draw down our troops in Afghanistan, well, geez, the Dagger Brigade, they're looking for something to do in order that they may stay globally engaged. And so what they've decided on is Africa. And now they're going around in Africa looking for armies to train, looking for fights to pick, looking for bases to build. They're just job holders, the same as any other bureaucrats. And for the generals, I mean, these guys are extremely well paid. The more stars they get means the more millions they make when they, quote, retire and go sit on boards of directors of these basically fascist defense firms. That, I mean, what do you call mercantilism in a state of permanent war? It's fascism. And it's the world's greatest racket. And then, of course, you have all those defense firms themselves and all their lobbying power. You know, we joked on the show back a few years ago. There was an article about, oh my God, Lockheed has spent $14 million, or maybe it was even $140. I think it was just $14. They spent $14 million on lobbying just in the first quarter of this year. And I'm going, $14 million? I mean, you might as well be talking about cents, right? You might as well be talking about less than a dollar. You're talking about so many decimal points removed from Lockheed profits. This is just the chumpest of chump change that it costs to keep congressmen entertained and eating steak dinners and snorting cocaine and having a good time and keeping them paid. And I mean, the real question is, who could stop it? If I had a question for you, it would be, especially since you read the whole book and including my section on the heroin and everything in there, it would be, you know, what did I really miss? Whose great book did I miss that really shows the directions, all the distribution networks of this heroin and how it gets around in the world and the American involvement? It's not like the 80s where they needed the cocaine money to fight their war because Congress wouldn't give it to them.
Right.
You know, but at the same time, boy, America's been occupying the place this whole time. You have all this heroin. It's their allies and their enemies are selling it into the global market. There's no question about that. But I think you probably even thought I fell short there. I did, too, because I just didn't know where to go with that chapter anymore. I didn't have the information.
It's funny that you bring that up because it got to, what, chapter four. And I was like, there isn't a single mention of poppies or opium in here. This is crazy. And then, of course, there's the little drug war section. So I was appeased. But you're right. I mean, there's not a lot of meat on the bones. But if you're asking me for a book recommendation, that's a good question because I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what else I should have written. Yeah, you know what I mean? Other than, well, geez, come on, what are we, stupid? The CIA must be making a killing. But even Alfred McCoy, I asked him and he's like,
that's exactly what I was going to say. I know he hasn't written anything on it recently.
I mean, I've interviewed him about it before and asked him, tell me everything you know. You know what I should do is read Peter Dale Scott. I've got him on my shelf, but I just haven't gotten to it.
That would be, and I have interviewed him on this. I'll put the link in the show notes for this in case people want to go back and refresh themselves. And we talked quite a bit about the Afghan poppy opium trade and all of that. But that was back several years ago now, so probably out of date. Unfortunately, every time I try to interview him, it's a terrible, terrible connection for some reason or other. So it never quite eventuates. Maybe you can get a better connection in the States and get a real good conversation there. But that would be my first recommendation for sure.
By the way, credit to him because when I was way back in high school as a teenager, I saw his documentaries about the war in Panama and cocaine, Ronald Reagan pushing cocaine and whatever. And he was one of my introductions to sort of alternative politics and what have you when I was a kid.
Awesome.
So a lot of respect for him. I admit I haven't read his books. I really should.
Absolutely. Well, put it on the reading list. I know I've kept you too long. So final thing, you've got 1 minute. You're being ushered into the Oval Office. Trump wants to give you a briefing because he read your book, or more likely someone read it over Fox News, so he actually heard it and is intrigued. He wants the 1 minute breakdown. Scott, you know I want to end this thing, but it's just politically impossible. What do I do?
Well, I mean, I think the answer there is you go out and you give a speech about how George Bush and Barack Obama are both weak, stupid losers. They had no idea what they were doing. They built a government that cannot last. And it's not fair to ask the American people to try to support a situation that could never stand on its own if we stayed for another 100 years. And so the Pashtun tribesmen are no longer our enemy. They never really should have been. And the government in Kabul, the Bush-Obama government in Kabul, is no longer America's responsibility. And we would like to see everyone negotiate, but that's it. We just should leave. And I think that, Mr. President, people might make fun of you if you actually negotiate and concede to the Taliban. I think better be to just go, right? Who cares if the North Vietnamese communists come down and conquer the South? Everybody is going to want to forget about it in another 2 months anyway, and just forget it. So, and I don't really believe that anyone in the government, I don't believe the State Department, the Pentagon, the CIA would allow any real final negotiated settlement with the Taliban anyway. So as I argue in the book, don't make a peace deal. Just leave. Just forget it and let them work the problems out themselves. And after all, only 20% of the American people support any troop increase right now. 20% have no opinion. Is that the greatest shame you ever heard in your entire life? And then 20% want to leave now. And then, you know, the rest were, I don't know, I guess if the president says so, or I left one off, whichever. Right. But, you know, there's certainly no support. That's more than a minute. Sorry. But Taliban, the Pashtuns didn't attack us. They don't deserve this. And I know the president knows better because he has already distinguished himself between the locals and international Arab terrorists. And so the safe haven myth is a lie. There's no reason to believe the Taliban would want Al-Qaeda to come back and get them in trouble with the empire again the way that they did before. And there's no reason to think that even if Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan, that would pose any special risk to the United States. And Bush and Obama already created 1,000 new safe havens from Basra to, Timbuktu, literally. So.
You know, the weirdest thing is this is right up Trump's alley. This is like what his candidacy was tailor-made for, is to say this is a bad deal, they made a stupid decision, we're wasting money, let's cut and run. And people would cheer. This is the time that could have been done, and of course it wasn't. So,
can I say one more thing about that?
Yes.
So on Twitter, he said over and over and over again, Obama, you dummy, end the war, right? But in 2012... when Obama was telling the generals, yeah, no, I meant it. We're doing the drawdown, and no, I'm not changing my mind, and you might as well shut up and stop asking, because they were trying to push it. Again, Trump took Obama's side and tweeted out that I stand with the president on this. Draw down now. So it wasn't just the lowest base partisan politics, or at least if it started out that way, he talked himself into really believing it. And it really became his position where he was even willing to support Obama against the generals when Obama was telling them no. And it's the same kind of thing, just like with the Iran deal. The Iran deal is the worst deal in the whole wide world. He didn't know the first thing about it. And we all know that, right? He was just staking out the political position all the way to the right so that nobody else in the Republican primary could be better than him on it from a Republican point of view, right? That's all it was. But then he said it 1,000 times. So now he really believes it. Now he wants to really destroy the Iran deal, even though it's a perfectly good deal in 1,000 ways. But it's the same kind of thing for good, I think, on Afghanistan. I think he really does agree with us. But, I mean, it's already too late for now, but not really. I mean, we're talking about Mr. Flip-Flop. He flip-flopped when he announced the escalation. I think he could flip-flop right back again and just say, you know, I learned a little bit more about it, and I decided this is stupid. And I looked at this mom whose son had died over there, and I was like, this is crazy. Sorry, lady, I'm going to end it now. for you.
Right.
That's all he has to say. And blame it on stupid Bush and weak loser Obama. What's so hard about that?
It would win applause. It would certainly Absolutely. Play to his base anyway. Yeah.
And in fact, one more thing again. He denounced Jeb and George Bush for the Iraq War in South Carolina, the most heavily militarized state in our union. Well, I don't know, Washington State. But the next day, and he got a bunch of boos for it in that Republican crowd in the debate. But the next day, he won South Carolina with a 2/3 supermajority, and he was running against 6 or 7 other guys still at that point. Okay, so that means the American right, that means the families who already lost one son in these wars, they are tired of this. They don't care anymore about your slogans about kicking butt. They don't care anymore about all this stuff about America, USA, number one. This is a very real situation to them, to their families, to their communities, and they are over it. It's 16 years now. In fact, I do go on. I apologize. But Colonel McGregor said on the Tucker Show on Fox News, he said the spirit of the force is broken. Listen, the infantry, they don't want to do this anymore. You can't go to war like that. Do you understand? Now, when a colonel is talking to you like that, when Colonel McGregor is talking to you like that on TV, it's time to tune in, pay attention. This could get really bad. You know, William S. Lynn says every army that ever got lost thought that they could never get lost, and yet they were.
Well, if there are any servicemen listening to this, let's just keep in mind, mutiny is always an option. You don't have to follow orders. Well, if there are two books you can read on Afghanistan, one would be American War Machine, Deep Politics, the CIA Global Drug Connection, and The Road to Afghanistan by Peter Dale Scott. But the other would be Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. If you haven't read it yet, please do so. I'll put the link in the show notes, obviously directly to the book, so you can go get your copy. Scott Horton, an interesting conversation. Sorry to throw the 9/11 thing at you, but I think my listeners needed to hear that and know where you're coming from. I think there's a good conversation that we can have, not a debate, not trying to score points or get a knockout, but just a real conversation on that subject. But today's conversation was not about that.
Yeah, sure. And I don't mind talking about that stuff. I mean, honestly, I was a truther before 9/11 ever happened. I predicted it for years. I was an Alex Jones head back in the 1990s. I was good on the Oklahoma bombing from the day it happened.
Absolutely.
On.
And can I just
from
say,
literally that day, I had a friend who was a Marine Corps Force Recon Vietnam veteran told me there was a bomb here and here and here.
Let me just put
it on
record.
I've been like this since before 9/11, but what happened was I saw the truthers get so much stuff wrong. They were basically the mirror image of Paul Wolfowitz trying to pin it on Saddam, trying to cherry pick and create their little story without really any regard for the truth anymore. And the more I really looked into it, the more I found this 10-year Al-Qaeda war against the United States that had already been going on.
I found people like
Ali Soufan saying, oh, man, if only the CIA had told me that Al-Qaeda was this, and this guy, and they were tied in this way, I would have been able to stop the attack. I mean, that's the kind of thing we're like, you know, they could have stopped it. If that's your conspiracy, that they could have stopped it, fine, but they could have stopped Al-Qaeda from doing it. That was the story, you know?
Well, let's not have that conversation now. I think
you can cut that out if you want.
Well, no. If you're up for it, we can have that. But let me just back up what you're saying there, because I have done a lot of work on OKC, and every time I'm researching in there, I'm all over your interviews. You have really, really covered OKC back to front with so much really quality stuff. So my hat's off to you for doing that.
It's an extremely important story. An important story.
Yeah. In some ways, perhaps even better than 9/11 in the sense of getting people to understand there's more to these events, because it's just so misunderstood and underexplored, even in the alternative media. So my hat's off to you for that. And my hat's off to you for this book. Well, again, we'll throw people to the Libertarian Institute website, to your website, and to the book directly. Scott Horton, thank you for your time.
Thank you.